The Jewish Hour is now on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm. Find it in your App Store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher, smart radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Herschel Thinman. We've got a great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we'll be interviewing Aaron Lansky of the National Jewish Book Depot. We're going to be talking about Yiddish books. Where's it all? What's it all about, Alfie, as we say? And we have lots of wonderful Jewish music. The portion of the week is the portion of Balak, which is found in chapter 22 of the book of Numbers and following. And we have a great story for you today. Oh, you're going to love this story. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. One Arab was killed in Gaza and three others wounded by celebrations after the Muslim Brotherhood won Egyptian elections. President-elect Mohamed Morsi said he would review the 1979 peace treaty that Egypt has with Israel. An Israeli military court ruled that Ibrahim Hamad, the former commander of Hamas military wing in the Palestinian Authority-controlled areas of Judea and Samaria, is guilty of the murder of 46 Israelis. Hamad was convicted of involvement in a series of suicide terror attacks in 2002. He is expected to be sentenced to a series of life sentences. Russian President Vladimir Putin in Israel this week met with Palestinian Authority Chairman Mahmoud Abbas in Beis Lechem, or you could call it Bethlehem. In a joint press conference following their meeting, Putin declared that Russia has no problem recognizing an independent Palestinian state, saying they did that 25 years ago and their position has not changed. It's fire season in Colorado and in Israel. 200 fires suspected to be the work of arsonists rage near Jerusalem, forcing the evacuation of 300 homes and closing the main highway between the capital of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv for several hours on Tuesday. Two Arab youths from East Jerusalem were arrested and charged with arson for setting several fires. One of the fires was set next to the IDF base on Mount Scopus. The other was set next to Hadassah Hospital on Mount Scopus. In Colorado Springs, the entire town was evacuated, including the Chabad House. The three towers in the building were moved to Denver. The District Court of Cologne, Germany, ruled that religious circumcision of a child is harmful and that a parent's jurisdiction over his child does not extend to the practice of circumcision. The decision, which affects Jews and Muslims, is being appealed. The Reparation Fund for the Victims of National Socialism, that means Nazis, is shutting down its Vienna office after 11 years due to limited finances. The fund has recognized claims totaling $1.5 billion, but is only able to pay $210 million because of this lack of funds. A total of 20,700 applicants were submitted to the fund since 2001. And finally, in some sport news, the debut of Israel's men's national lacrosse team in the European Lacrosse Championships came to an end as number 8 Netherlands rolled to a 18-13 quarterfinal win in Amsterdam. The unranked blue and white became the Cinderella of the tournament by topping Wales, France, Norway, and Slovakia to win their group. And that's the news. You know the best place to buy fruit and vegetables? Why, it's at Fruitasia. Located on Southfield Road, just south of the 13 Mile, Fruitasia provides quality, value, and the most wonderful environment to shop. You'll enjoy the spacious aisles, excellent selection, great prices, and friendly staff at Fruitasia on Southfield Road and 13 Mile. Hey, Herschel Thinman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have online Aaron Lansky, who is the director of the National Yiddish Book Center. Was macht der Yid? How you doing, Aaron?
How are you, Herschel? Nice to speak with you again.
Good. Baruch Hashem. It's only been, let's see, last time was 1997, so it's only been like 15 years.
So, boy, how much time have we got? We have a little catching up to do here.
We certainly do. So the National Yiddish Book Center became an item way back two decades ago when people were raising their eyebrows and saying, You mean there's somebody who actually wants these old Jewish books that no one can read anymore? Okay, they were my grandfather's, but I don't want them. And the Zommelers went out, and lo and behold, you had a book depository, and people were sending you books. So what's happened since 1997?
Well, first of all, that was 3 decades ago that we started, but who's counting?
Okie doke.
And, you know, boy, a lot's happened. So first, like, I should start out with just to bring you up to date. You know, we've saved most of the books that were out there. You know, after 3 decades on the road and, you know, more meals at more people's apartments than I can ever count as they handed us their Yerusha, you know, their inheritance of Yiddish books, we've collected well over 1 million volumes. Then I think since I talked to you last, we ended up digitizing most of those volumes. We got help from Steven Spielberg and others, and we scanned every page of many of the books. 3 years ago, we posted them online in their entirety. And the big news, so in 3 years, they've been downloaded 300,000 times.
Wow.
So for all those who said, who in the world's ever going to read this stuff, I'm happy to say there is vindication. And I'm even happier to say that most of those readers are probably under 30 years of age.
That is incredible. That is incredible. So out of 1.5 million books, how many different titles are we talking about?
Literature is maybe 40,000 titles, and I would say in our collection it's probably closer to 20,000, although by definition it's the books that were most widely read.
Okay. So you have them because those are the ones that people had.
Exactly.
How many complete copies of the works of Shalom Aleichem do you have sitting on the shelves?
Well, first of all, they're not all sitting on the shelves anymore because we've been sending books out to libraries all over the world. But I would say we probably safely have 1,000 or so, you know, complete editions of the 28-volume works of Shalom Aleichem still sitting here. So if you want to get in, you know, you can still sign up and find one.
Mm-hmm. So what does a person have to do to say if they're thinking, you know, I'm starting to learn Yiddish, and I really would like to get my hands on a book. What would they do, Aaron Lansky, to pick up something, or they're taking like a Yiddish course in college or something like that, and they're not making new books, are they?
Well, that's a big question too. There is some Yiddish literature now being published in the Hasidic world, where of course they still use Yiddish as a spoken language. Although it's very different than you know much of the literature that we're dealing with here.
Sure, we have the Rebbe Retzu Kinder on our shelf.
You do?
Yeah,
you have.
Betcha.
Yeah, so in fact, we have a program for college students, and they spent all of yesterday in Borough Park walking around and trying out their newly learned Yiddish within a living community there, which is fascinating in its own right. But in terms of how to find the books, you know, people certainly can go onto our website at yiddishbookcenter.org, and they can find, you know, all sorts of Yiddish books that they can then order, you know, as what librarians call artifactual copies, meaning real books, you know, are still available as duplicate copies of older editions. But they can also be even quicker about it and just go online at yiddishbooks.org. And as I said, they'll find, you know, at the moment about 11,000 titles there in their entirety. They can download them onto a computer or an iPad or an iPod or anything that they have. And so the books are essentially instantly accessible. In fact, the New York Times wrote an article about what we were doing, and they said that Yiddish is now proportionately is now the single most accessible literature on the planet.
That is incredible. I mean, does that include, I mean, we have like, for example, you have like Google Books, for example, that's got several hundred thousand titles on it, so.
Right, but the key word there is the proportionality. Because, you know,
okay. In
other words, as a proportion of the entire literature, it's really astonishing how much is available. Part of it's because a lot of the Yiddish books were never copyrighted in the first place. So all of this was sort of in the public domain. You know, we thought they were orphan works, meaning there was still current copyright, but no one knew who owned that copyright. But in fact, very few of them ever bothered to register back when the books were published. I always thought it was because they didn't really know how to handle America, you know, and how to operate here. But I spoke with my teacher, Ruth Weiss, about this recently, and she said, oh, that wasn't the reason. And I said, well, what was the reason? She said, because no one in their wildest dreams could have imagined they would ever make money out of selling Yiddish books. But whatever the case, you know, most of the literature is in the public domain and therefore has a chance to be accessible in a way that no other literature does.
Mm-hmm. You can answer me a question. Here's that for English. Answer a question. I am fluent in Yiddish, and in my classes, every once in a while, I'll say, there's this old Yiddish expression, and then I say, well, all Yiddish expressions are old because they're not making up any new ones. So is that true, Aaron Lansky? Are people coming up with new jargon cliches in Yiddish?
Well, I suspect it's happening all the time wherever Yiddish is still being used as a living language. You know, things change constantly and new expressions are always being coined, so I suspect it's still quite vibrant in some places. But, you know, nothing that we think of in Yiddish, though, is all that old. You know, sometimes I have people walk into our headquarters here in Amherst, Massachusetts, and the place looks like a shtetl. It's one of the great Jewish tourist destinations. You walk in, you're on a balcony, you're overlooking an ocean of Jewish books out there, and people say, well, you know, where do all these ancient books come from? But, of course, the truth is they're not ancient books. They, by definition, are actually modern books. You know, so Yiddish literature, well, Yiddish language was spoken for 1,000 years, but, you know, what we know of as modern Yiddish literature really starts in the late 19th century as Jews try to figure out how to live in a modern world. And I suspect a great many of the proverbs and expressions date from that period as well. I mean, they have a kind of energy about them. It was as though, you know, kind of all the, you know, power and marginality and outsider's perspective that had lain latent in the language for 1,000 years suddenly came bursting forth in the modern period. So all of the old Yiddish expressions are probably not as old as we think they are.
Uh-huh. I'm the one that comes to my mind, which I quote quite often, is if someone is like pointing a finger at someone. My grandmother used to say, if you're pointing at somebody with one finger, you're pointing at yourself with three. You know, as you're looking at your hand, as you're pointing with somebody, there's three fingers actually pointing back to you. This is like the colorfulness what you're telling somebody is don't do that pointing stuff, but it's not more don't do that pointing stuff. There's just like this whole color in it, and there's like a whole philosophy in it. And is that really sort of like a carry through from like Judaism, the religion, into Jewish culture, Aaron Lansky?
Yeah, I think, you know, what we really represent here as an organization increasingly is the inseparability of the two. I mean, Yiddish language is a product of the, it was the language that 3/4 of the world's Jews spoke for 1,000 years. So just as, you know, Inuit or Eskimo languages have a great many words for snow, you know, a Jewish language, of course, has a great many words and expressions for, you know, essentially Jewish concepts. And therefore, I think the interest is just growing all the time. I got to tell you, though, you know, when we first started collecting these books, it was a little bit, it didn't take us long to figure out that the fact that Jewish or Yiddish books had been discarded was really emblematic of a much bigger problem. I mean, you think about it, Jews are such a bookish people. You know, we venerate books. We see books as a portable homeland. You know, when I was a kid growing up in New Bedford, Massachusetts, if we dropped a book on the floor, whether it was a Tanakh or it was Norman Mailer, we picked it up and we kissed the book. It was just sort of, you know, I don't know, it was just instinctive. It was kind of how we were raised, was that respect for books. Yet here was a people, we threw away an entire literature. And what we began to realize was, wow, it wasn't just a literature, it wasn't just books that we threw away. It was really the kind of whole cultural side of our identity. And I think that's a much broader agenda for us right now, is how do you, you know, reclaim this kind of vast cultural constellation and make a far more holistic sense of Jewish identity today. The good news is young people are very much inclined in that direction, and therefore we are, if we're awash in books, we're even more awash in young people these days.
I got 7 of them, yes, indeedy. I mean, it seems my wife is an extensive traveler, and whenever she goes anywhere, she comes back and tells us about Jewish wherever. And what she seems to notice in traveling around Europe, specifically where there are so many languages, and decades ago, the way that a Jew traveled around Europe was through Yiddish, but she said now it's Hebrew. And the difference between Yiddish and Hebrew is Yiddish is this warm, fuzzy, friendly language, like can I take you home and feed you type language. And Hebrew is very functional. It's like 3-letter words with like things stuck on them and off them, and if you have to know where to put them, and it's like this very masculine language, it's like your Zeta language, whereas Yiddish is called Mamalush, and it's your grandmother's language. What would you say about that?
Well, we have here a Yiddish translation of the Tanakh, of the Bible, that was done by a poet named Yehoash. And in it,
I have a copy of that. Yes.
Yeah. So remember the book. Think of it, it's got like a block of Hebrew type with the Hebrew text,
right?
And then it gives the Yiddish translation. in the Hebrew text is maybe one-fifth of the page because it's so concise, and the rest of the page is the Yiddish that sort of says it in a far more discursive sort of way. Of course, you know, look, what we speak of today as Hebrew is modern Hebrew, which was itself a creation of Yiddish-speaking East European Jews who really wanted to break from the diaspora, you know, and create a very different kind of language. So, of course, the pronunciations were changed to make it sound less like Yiddish. You know, what you refer to as its masculinity was an intentional decision, right? We changed the, they changed the accent from the penultimate to the ultimate syllables. So, you know, and hardened up the sound. So Rachmunis, you know, pity, becomes Rachmanut, right, which is a much harder sounding.
Yeah, it doesn't even sound like a merciful word, Rachmanut, whereas Rachmanis is like, you know, it's onomatopoetic.
Yeah. Right. So that was, you know, an intentional decision that was made. But you know what, as I say, all languages carry the culture of their people, of the people who speak them. And I think Hebrew has plenty Jewish going on there. But Yiddish certainly has a role to play as well, you know, because it's a key to understanding the diasporic experience, and it's a key to understanding 1,000 years of Jewish creativity. So there's really a lot locked up in it.
Mm-hmm. Our guest today, if you're just tuning in, is Aaron Lansky. He is the director of the National Yiddish Book Center, and they have a wonderful website, yiddishbookcenter.org. You mentioned before that a group of newly Yiddish polyglogs have descended on Borough Park, which is a religious neighborhood. And I know that among the religious Yiddish-speaking groups, there's something that they refer to quite disdainfully as the Yiddishists. And those are those people who speak Yiddish, they and associated with communism and socialism, everything except Judaism per se. So now, so this is Borough Park, this is 2012. How is this type of group accepted in these religious circles? I mean, if they're buying stuff, I'm sure everybody accepts
that. That is such a good question, and my answer today is going to be really different than what it would have been a few years ago. So I remember a few years ago we sent a group down to Borough Park, and they were in our van, and they got lost. And they stopped on a street corner to ask Chosid for directions. And the guy who was driving the van speaks a quite perfect, young guy who's probably in his 20s, but he spoke a perfect Yiddish. And he says to him, "Could you tell me how to get to such, you know, wherever he was going to?" And the chassid looks at him, and he just stared for a minute or two, and finally he says, "Mr. Yid, are you Jewish?" Because he couldn't believe, you know, that secular people would speak what they kind of saw as their private language. And by the way, I don't think they think of socialism and communism anymore. I think now they, you know, they see that as kind of just representative of the outside world or a secular world altogether. Mm-hmm. But I think things are changing quite a lot. You know, even the Hasidic world is far less ossified than one might imagine. I went with the students to Borough Park last year. We're walking down the street, and most of the stores now have signs in English, unless it's something to do with anything Jewish. Then the sign will be in Hebrew or in Yiddish. So we walk by one place, and it's a barber shop, and it's got a barber pole on the sign, and it says barber in English. And then underneath it are two words. First word is payas, of course, the side curls, you know, worn by Hasidic men. And the next word appears to be fei ayin resh mem. So I was with one of our professors, and she said to me, "What do you think that means,
payas
perm?" And I said, "I don't think it means fam exactly. I think it means payas perm, because this is where you go to get your payases permed, because they don't just curl naturally like that." So you know what? Sahintika velt. No matter how much one tries to, you know, abstain from it, the world's always out there. And in fact, a friend of mine recently at Stanford did an analysis of the books that we have online and which books are being downloaded. And it appears that a significant number of those Yiddish books that are being read by Hasidim. In the last few years, most of them have gotten computers, and they're opening up to the outside world. And even though it's not quite sanctioned, they're turning to this secular Yiddish literature as a way of understanding, you know, their own.
I wonder Yiddish what they would have said about the Yiddish Book Center at that big rally at City
Let's
Stadium.
Let's just be grateful they didn't.
At least he has a kosher website. Now, I told this story, I think, in 1997 when I interviewed him. If you could remember this story, because it's a really cute story. We talk about going and visiting, because I had learned yeshiva. My mother spoke a beautiful Yiddish. I wish I spoke Yiddish like my mother spoke to my grandmother. But it gave me enough of a ring of the inflection, how it's supposed to sound. So I could talk gibberish Yiddish when I was a kid, and not saying words, but have the right inflection. But so I actually learned Yiddish in yeshiva. And then I wound up in Miami Beach, which is like the center of Yiddish culture.
Yes, right.
So I was talking with this woman on the street, in Yiddish. And she's shaking her head yes, shaking her head yes, shaking her head yes. And after about 3 minutes of me just like thinking, boy, I'm really doing very well, she stops me and she says in perfect English, young man, you speak Yiddish like a Turk. So...
Yes, you know, in Yiddish, if you want to say it's all Greek to me, you say it's all Sterkayish by mir.
Yeah.
You know, it's all Turkish by me. That's about as exotic as one can get. So that's very interesting. You know, look, it's never going to be what it was. You know, we're not. This is not a nostalgic enterprise, and we're not trying to move back in time. What we're trying to do is create a vibrant Jewish life in a modern world. And the truth is that Jews' first great literary encounter, you know, with the modern world, took place in Yiddish. There were more books published in Yiddish in a shorter time than at any other point in all of Jewish history. You know, more people were speaking Yiddish in 1939 than have ever spoken any Jewish language before or since. So the significance of this historically is not, you know, it's a big deal in Jewish history. And the really big news is just how many young people are turning to it now. You know, so not just Yiddish, but I say to a more holistic understanding of their own culture. So now, you know, we started out with internship program in the summertime that's now grown into a full-fledged, you know, summer Yiddish language institute. We have a fellowship program here where we brought students in, recent college graduates with Jewish studies background, usually they have Hebrew and Yiddish, and they come here for a year at a time. They're now running most of our major programs because they come with good Yiddish knowledge. And so, boy, everything we're doing now, translation and, you know, outreach to college students and oral history work and radio production, we have so many different programs going on, and all of these are being spearheaded by people under 30 years of age.
People who have strength and aren't all that upstairs. Yeah. I'm assuming you're still not getting into, like, rented trucks and going into people's barns and alleyways and whatnot and rescuing books still, are you, Aaron? Personally.
That's calmed down a lot. You know, what little bit of that work we do is generally overseas at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But in the United States and Canada, most of the books are probably safe at this point. But, you know, there are always surprises. Things always come in. You know, 10,000 books arrived a few weeks ago. You never quite know what's going to happen. So you want to hear something really interesting?
Go ahead.
I was up in Montreal last year. I went to graduate school at McGill. So I'm up in Montreal with my daughter, who was looking at the schools up there. And I said, why don't we stop at the Yiddische Volksbibliothek, the Jewish Public Library, which is still one of the major Jewish institutions there. We walk in. I sat down to schmooze with the director for a little while, whom I know very well. And she said, by the way, would you have any interest in those tapes we have? I said, what tapes are those? Well, it turns out in the 70s and 80s, they had Yiddish, you know, there were still Yiddish actors alive in Montreal. And they were going into the library, into a recording studio, and reading aloud recordings of full-length Yiddish novels.
Oh, books on tape in Yiddish. Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So this is wild, you know, because to hear Yiddish now in the voice of these native speakers is tough to find. So we quickly made an arrangement, and we agreed that we would remaster all these materials. And I then sat down and wrote a letter to our members announcing this and looking for money to pay for the processing of everything. And I get an email back from a friend of mine who once worked at the library, and he said, you know, when you go up there to pick up these cassette tapes of the books on tape, he says, check out down in the cellar. He said, I seem to remember that there were a lot of boxes of reel-to-reel tapes down there, too. I'm not sure what they were, but you should check them out. So I sent two of our students up to Montreal with a van. It turns out there were 1,500 old reel-to-reel tapes dating back to the late 1940s onward. And basically, you know, Montreal was one of the great Yiddish-speaking communities, largely because when the Jews got there, neither the English nor the French exactly embraced them with open arms, and the Jews were able to maintain their own cultural institutions to a far greater extent than elsewhere. Even now, a lot of the Jewish schools in Montreal are
still
quadrilingual, French, English, Yiddish, and Hebrew. And so for many, many years, like the whole second half of the 20th century, all of the world's great Yiddish writers were making the pilgrimage up to Montreal. I remember when I was a grad student there in the late 70s, they would have a lecture on a Saturday night, you know, on some relatively obscure subject of Yiddish literature. It would be 10 below zero and 300 people would turn out for this. And unbeknownst to me, They had professional analog recording equipment, and they were recording these lectures for year after year after year. And there it was, it all kind of stashed away in the basement. So we are now systematically, we brought everything back, we're systematically reprocessing it. We have a company in Boston that's doing the actual restoration and digitization. And then we have a brilliant fellow here named Jordan Kutzik, who is works every day taking the materials and putting new, what they call metadata, you know, cataloging records, and he enters it in Yiddish. So when you play this on your iPod, it actually shows up in Yiddish on the outside of the iPod. And
wow.
Boy, the world's changing fast. So, you know, the moral of the story is we've saved most of the books, but who knows what other treasures are still waiting to be found.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of treasures, I remember back in 1997, I asked you a question. If there was any one volume that you're really impressed that the National Yiddish Book Center owns, do you have one book? And you came up with one book. I'm not going to tell you what that one book was. I'm going to see how you answer that question now in 2012, and I'll tell you what you answered back in 1997.
I bet you I told you about that dictionary.
That's it. As you told me about the dictionary.
Yeah, that was published in Kiev in 1929, and it was turned out to be the last surviving copy in the world. The KGB or the NKVD had destroyed every copy of the book when it was published, and but a cousin of the author had been visiting at the time, walked out of the printing shop with one copy of the book, blithely went back to the United States, not knowing that the secret police came in shortly thereafter and destroyed the rest of the books. So, yes, that was good. But, you know, other books show up all the time. You never know what's going to turn up here. I remember some years ago, a truck backs up to our loading dock. And the guy said, I'm going to need help with this. And he's got a gigantic wooden crate, like it looks like the size of two refrigerators, you know, all banged together. And it had a return address of Bulawayo, which is in Zimbabwe, formerly Rhodesia. So after the war, a lot of Jews had gone there, you know, taken refuge in, mm-hmm. in what was Rhodesia at the time, an English-speaking country. And they spread out all over Africa, and they did a lot of Yiddish publishing, you know, in Yiddish kind of accounts of, you know, travels through the interior of Africa. There was a book about a commune of Yiddish-speaking ostrich farmers somewhere in South Africa.
Oh, how wild.
And anyways, all these books had been left behind. The Jews left very quickly when colonialism unraveled, and they left most of the books behind. They had been in the basement of the old synagogue in Bulawayo. A rabbi from South Africa found out about it. He went up there, had them all packed up, put everything in this crate, shipped it all to us. We had to get crowbars. We open up the crate. It's like treasures like we've never seen, you know, imprints we never heard of before. And then a few years later, we got a telegram telling us that that library, that whole shul, had burned to the ground.
Oh, my goodness.
And if the books had been removed, you know, they would have been destroyed. So the answer is yes, there are amazing books all the time that keep coming in, and or sometimes we just, you know, go through the stacks and you just find things that you kind of can't believe exist. So you know, the big problem, of course, is so little of it's been translated.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, out of all of Yiddish literature, about 2% have been translated into English.
Well, that would just mean that people have to learn Yiddish then now, doesn't it?
Well, that would mean that, but since not everyone's going to learn English, learn Yiddish, rather. Look, I read War and Peace. I thought it was one of the greatest books I ever read, but I didn't read it in Russian, right? I read mm-hmm. it in English translation. And so translation's, you know, necessary. I mean, translation, as you know well, has, you know, always been a big part of Jewish tradition. You know, the right. idea of Targum goes back a long way.
Yeah, it's the hardest thing to do is translate. It actually
yeah.
is.
It's really hard because you're translating not just words, you're translating a culture, and you have to explain it and make it come alive. And you know that expression they say, "Ala kala zenin shein, ala toita zenin frum." You know, all brides are beautiful, all dead people are pious. So I think after the war, you know, there was a tendency that the books that did get translated then tended to be the schmaltzier books, or the books that kind of showed this world, you know, in a rosier light, and the books that were full of conflict and contradiction, and, you know, in short, you know, the best literature tended to be overlooked.
Right.
So it's only now that we are, you know, wanting to come to terms with all of this, but 98% of the books haven't been translated yet. So we've had a program at Yale University Press for the past 10 years. We had every major scholar in the world working on it, Yiddish scholar working on it, and we managed to put out a book a year. They're really good translations. They're great books. But somewhere along the way, we said, wow, you know, at this rate, we're doing a book a year. At this rate, it's going to be another 39,000 years before we finish the project.
Right.
And clearly, we've got to find another way. And obviously, the only other way is to train young people to do it. You know, you can't just count on six people who are in their late 80s to do the translating for us. So we held a conference here a few months ago to talk about how do we get a new generation involved in this. We were expecting 25 people. 100 showed up. We came up with a whole bunch of really exciting plans, everything from fellowships for young people where each one will be assigned an individual mentor to help them work on a book-length work of translation so they can learn the craft of translation, to online publishing, to a brand-new website that's going to allow for a kind of wiki review of works in progress, and even more importantly, will allow people to be able to post words that don't appear in the dictionary. About 10 to 15% of the words in any given Yiddish books don't appear in Yiddish dictionaries. So you can post words, and people around the world can, they call it wiki, but, you know, can kibitz and kind of, you know, come up with meanings and argue with one another and provide resources for the working translators. And just this week, actually, we got two grants, one from the Righteous Persons Foundation from Steven Spielberg to pay for the website, and one from the David Berg Foundation in New York to pay for the fellowships. So we are about to hit the ground running and, full steam ahead and just train a whole new generation to do this. So who knows what sort of treasures will see the light of day in the next few years, but we are very optimistic about it.
That sounds absolutely marvelous. Okay, this is going to be the last question I have for you. I am at your website, and it just occurred to me, I have been looking for about 35 years for the English translation of Tanya, Volume 1. I have Volume 2. But Volume 1, I think they made one printing of it back in the 40s or maybe early 50s, and I have never seen it anywhere. If I wanted to track this down at your website, how would I do that, Aaron Lansky?
You go to yiddishbooks.org.
Okay.
And you're interviewing me on the right day. As of literally yesterday, we've now developed Yiddish alphabet search capability. Up until now, you had to search for books in Romanization, which we know is transliteration, right? You know, in English letters. And it was a pain in the neck for people outside of the United States because our Romanization system doesn't make a lot of sense if you're living in Poland or elsewhere, or even in Mexico, where words and letters have different equivalents. So there's now a drop-down Yiddish keyboard. And all you have to do is just type it in. Don't put the diacriticals. Just, type in the
word.
Type in the word. You can type in keyword, title, or author, and it will instantly search all of our holdings, and you will see if we have the book available. And in another few months, it's going to go a step beyond that, and we're going to have what's called text search capability as well. There's a brilliant scholar came forward from Toulouse, France, who has single-handedly developed Yiddish OCR. If you don't mind my mixing metaphors, this has always been the holy grail of Jewish scholarship, is to find a way to actually search the texts themselves. So right now, if you were to try to look through, 5 million pages of Yiddish literature, it may take you 10 years to do it. Once a software ELE's program is completed, you'll be able to do that same search in a matter of seconds. It'd be like doing a Google search, and every time a word appears anywhere in Yiddish literature, it'll pop up, and the reference will be right there. So the moral of the whole story is it's a Heintike Welt. It really is a new world and a new day, and the story of Yiddish is far from over.
Okay, that's going to do it. Our guest has been Aaron Lansky, who's the director of the National Jewish Book Center. You can check out their website, yiddishbookcenter, that's all one word, .org. And let's see, it was 15 years. So where do you think you're going to be 15 years from now, Aaron?
You'll call me then, and I'll let you know.
Okay, your prophecy doesn't extend that. So you're not that much of a Navi. Okay.
Well, whatever it'll be, I promise it'll be exciting.
Okay, we'll take you on that. Okay, that'll do it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Hershey.
We're gonna take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
The Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park is something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. We have some music for you. This is brand new. This is actually, this is a very a somber piece of bit. It was written in memory of those four people who were killed recently in Toulouse by the terrorist. The song is called Achenu, Our Brother. And this, the artist's name is a French singer. His name is Ohayon. Let's listen in.
Achenu, 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 Besisoe, Anesu, Batoro, Uvashivio, Bein Batoro, Uvashivio, Achenu, 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 Besisroe, Anesu, Batoro. Vashivyo Bein Matzoro Vashivyo
Healthcare offers patients the advantage of a safe and natural method of healing without the use of drugs or surgery. People of all ages, including children, benefit from chiropractic's unique approach to health. Call area code 248-557-1818 today to find out how chiropractic can benefit your family. At the Solomon Chiropractic Center, we especially love children. All kids should have their spines checked periodically throughout their crucial growing years. Growth on a crooked foundation will create a crooked spine and become harder to correct later in life. Kids love to get adjusted at the Solomon Chiropractic Center. And hey, moms, did you know that chiropractic offers a safe, drug-free approach to helping with the many pains women often get during and after pregnancy? We even have special tables which open up so pregnant women can lay on their stomachs. We treat moms, dads, children, and grandparents with arthritic pains, neck pains, back pain, and headaches. People of all ages, including kids, benefit from chiropractic. Come experience the natural method of healing without the use of drugs or surgery. Stop living in pain. Call area code 248-557-1818 today for a free consultation at the Solomon Chiropractic Center to discuss you and your family's health needs. Remember, 557-1818. That's 557-HI-HI.
Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mycosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mycosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. It's birthright season for you. Those don't know what that means. There is this organization called Birthright, which thinks it is the right of every young person to go visit Israel, which is a really wonderful thing. And I wish they did it when I was younger. I still consider myself a young person, but I'm older than 18 to 26, which is the age limit. So right now, as we speak, there are two Finmans on Birthright, and I have a daughter who actually went to Birthright and then decided she's going to stay there and is in university there and because of Birthright. So we got for your listening pleasure in honor of the Finman kids and all the other 40,000 Jewish children who are on Birthright night. Children, this is Schlockreich, Walking the Land.
Walking the land, it's Eretz Yisrael, pounding the pavement with this is Frank Lovasco with Lovasco Concrete Services. We specialize in driveways and patios. You can call me at 586-822-9985.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000. Or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Know the best place to buy fruit and vegetables? Why, it's at Fruitasia. Located on Southfield Road, just south of the 13 Mile, Fruitasia provides quality, value, and the most wonderful environment to shop. You'll enjoy the spacious aisles, excellent selection, great prices, and friendly staff at Fruitasia on Southfield Road and 13 Mile.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. This week is the portion of Balak. It can be the book of Numbers, chapter 22. The story talks about how Balak, the king of Midian, hired Balaam, or Bilaam as his Hebrew name is, to curse the Jews. And he couldn't curse them, so he said, get the Jewish people to worship your idol, and then God will take care of them. And that's what happened, and lots of people died after they got involved with this. Now, what was the idol that the Midianites worshipped? It was called Baal Pe'er. Baal Pe'er means, in Hebrew, to go to the bathroom, which is an interesting name for the idol. What happened? How did this whole idolatrous service work? Is when it was first made, people would become so ecstatic and so involved and just taken to the heights of whatever it was that they lost bodily control. And they would go to the bathroom right in front of the idol. The next generation, they got a little bit excited, but they understood that you don't get really excited. You can't prove you're excited until you go to the bathroom right in front of the idol. And by the third and fourth generation, the whole thing became go to the bathroom in front of the idol. That became, they didn't work themselves up into any frenzies. All they did was just go up to the idol and, for lack of a better word, take a dump. This is what the idolatrous practice was. And for most people, that would be considered like totally and completely sacrilegious. And that's how they enticed the Jewish people, is says, hey, would you like to come and defecate in front of our idol? And they said, why, sure. Which, not understanding that that was the way that you worshipped this idol. Now, what I'm going to talk about today is what is significance does that have for us in the year 2012? The stories, this is not just Jewish trivial pursuit. These stories have importance to us today. It says that there is a creation process. This is discussed in the Kabbalah. There is a creation process. And in order for the creation to occur, the infinite amount of godliness has to be contained through numerous and an infinite number of containments. And at after every containment along the process, there is another manifestation of godliness. What happens is a certain amount of godliness is used for what needs to be done, and the leftover godliness just kind of like gets sucked up into the forces of evil, which is how the forces of evil come into existence. Is not that they're really being created specifically in mind as entities, but they're receiving their life force in a behind-the-back way, as it's called. Like if you had a prisoner of war, you wouldn't be feeding him rib steaks. It's just whatever's left over. This is the king's dog eats the leftovers from the banquets. So one of the analogies as to the pleasures of this world are called balpa'ur, which in English we'd call that angel poop. What does that mean? Is you have these things. The Bible talks about these things called angels. In Judaism, we don't really put a whole lot on angels. They're discussed in the book of Isaiah and Ezekiel and Habakkuk and a couple other places. But, yeah, it doesn't excite me. So this is what is it? It's a way of conveying godliness down. And what happens is a certain specific amount of godliness is conveyed where it needs to go. And the waste godliness becomes the pleasures of the world. So that's why we put so much emphasis on where's the true pleasure is in holiness. The other pleasures of the world, for lack of a better word, they're just poop. Meaning, not to say that you shouldn't get involved with them, but you should know how. And we've talked about that before. We've got to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
This is Jim Hiller. At Hiller's, we support all things Michigan, which is why we support The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Spex Howard from the Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for The Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Best way? RabbiFinman.com, RabbiFinman. You'll find archive editions of the show. You'll find the E-Parsh, the U-Parsh, and the Hasidic U story, which are texts and videos of yours truly, with insights into the portion of the week and Hasidic stories. You'll also find the very important donation page. It's July, it's a new month, and like every month we start, we know we have the sponsors who give us a little bit, but the vast majority of the Jewish Hour is now listener-supported just like yourself. Let's see if we can get the month paid off before July 8th. That would be, like, way cool if we could do it. If you go to the computer right now and go to Rabbi Finman, hit the donation page, punch in the number that you like, just click it on. It's all PayPal. It's all very safe and secure. And we'll appreciate it. You'll appreciate it. God will appreciate it. If you don't like computers, send a check to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. The story of the week involves a gentleman from Brazil who came into a rabbi's study and said, "My daughter wants to intermarry. What do I do?" She says, "Okay, let me speak to her." So he went to the young woman, he spoke to her, and she basically threw him out, said, "Get out." And he knew that he didn't have any way really of talking to this woman. And so he called up Lubavitch. He himself was not a Lubavitcher. And got on the phone with the Rebbe's secretary and said, "What do I tell this girl?" And the secretary said, "Hold on a second." Came back and said, "You should tell her that there is a Jew in Brooklyn who cannot sleep at night because she wants to intermarry." And this man was very confused, and he said, "Who is this Jew in Brooklyn?" And then he heard the Rebbe's voice. The Rebbe had been listening on the phone. Mendel Schneerson was his name, said the voice on the line. So he understood very quickly what was going on. So he said, "Thank you very much." And then he said, "What is it going to help talking to this woman about the Lubavitcher Rebbe?" The phone rang. It was the Rebbe's secretary. And the Rebbe's secretary said, "Mendar Falgen." He says, "You just have to listen on Sveikas and don't have any doubts." So he said, "Okay, good." So he called up this woman again, and she did not want to speak to him. But she finally acquiesced. He said, "One more thing I want to tell you, and then I'll leave." She comes in. She sits down. She says, "Rabbi, I have no patience for you anymore." And she says, "But there's a Jew in Brooklyn who can't sleep at night because you want to intermarry." She went into a rage. Who gives a hoot about some Jew in Brooklyn? And she's carrying on and get out and don't ever bother me again. And he says, wait a minute. Let me show you a picture of this rabbi. And so he takes out a picture of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and this she stops. And she says, "I have been having dreams for the last week that this rabbi comes to me and says, don't marry her. Don't marry this guy." And I thought it's just because I was seeing you and I was thinking about rabbis and this. I says, no wonder he can't sleep at night. He's too busy talking to me in my dreams. And she didn't get married. Anyway, that's the show. We're going to thank you so much for tuning in. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great and awesome week. Enjoy the summertime. And we hope to see you back again here next week. Take care. So long.